This is episode 427 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abual-Salmon from Telemetry.
I am Roberto Baldwin from SAE International.
And I guess I'm Craig Cole with multiple outlets, but let's just say Auto Esoterica on YouTube.
Craig, thank you for joining us today. Nicole, I think, is in Mexico this weekend. She was at the Baja 1000. So I appreciate you taking the time to step in and join us today.
I appreciate the invite. I've never been on the show before. I hear good things. We'll see if those are lies or not.
Most of them are lies.
Glad to be here.
you had me on your former show a couple of times. Figured good time to return the favor. Tell the audience who may not be familiar with who Craig Cole is. Who the hell are you?
That's a good question. I ask myself that all the time.
What is Craig Cole? How is Craig Cole?
Are you done with the interrogatives? When is Craig Cole?
Where is Craig Cole?
I have covered, I've worked in automotive media for damn near 20 years now. I've known you for many of those years, Sam. But I've worked at a number of publications. I do everything, feature stories, news articles, first drives. I've done it all in the business. Mostly covering, trying to get our own YouTube channel up and running now, which, believe it or not, is very hard. So it's called Auto Esoterica. We try to focus more on like classic cars and stuff. Kind of what we feel is a bit of an underserved market these days, with quality content at least. So that's sort of the background on me. I've been there, I've done that, and I'm here now. So.
Craig is a man lost in time.
Yes,
he certainly is.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. I mean, you've got some at least one interesting old car. I'm not sure if you have other ones. Tell us about what you've got in your garage.
Well, I've got 1.5 interesting old cars, I say right now. So I've got my full old car is a 1936 Ford V8, completely restored. I did that with my dad, frame off, everything, which required so much welding and metal work and finishing, but super satisfying. The car drives like a brand new 90-year-old vehicle, which is terrifying. But because if you've never driven a car that old, you don't appreciate how far things have come, because it's like a tractor that'll do 100 miles an hour. It's something if you've never experienced that. Surprisingly modern in some ways, too. Like, the powertrain is super smooth. The clutch pedal feels great, but also then the handling is nautical. The brakes are not good. I've never driven a car with more body roll ever. So if you haven't driven it, Sam, we'll have to get you in the driver's seat sometime.
Yeah, I haven't driven yours. I think the oldest thing that I've driven was like a first generation Chevy Silverado, Suburban. Some years back, GM was doing a thing to celebrate, I think, the 75th anniversary of the Suburban. And they brought out a bunch of the different generations. And they did this out of Belle Isle and got to get a little time behind the wheel of that first generation one, which was, that would have been around about 30s. The same time. Yeah, early mid-30s time frame.
Because that's the longest running uninterrupted nameplate, right, in U.S.
Yeah, that is the claim, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So
I'm making my own cars. I'm a vampire.
But yeah, I've got the 36. That's done and been drivable for maybe 10 years now, and I'm about halfway done restoring a 51 Ford Crestliner. So I'm trying to wrap up the paintwork now before it's too cold, which I may have failed at that. But if I get it painted this winter, I can start putting it together. So very excited about that. And I just yesterday got the engine back from the machine shop. A 2.5 year wait. It took 2.5 years, but the machine work is done and I can put that together now when I get time.
That was 2.5 years just to like get the block and heads in that machine?
Wow. Yeah, to machine the block and balance everything. I mean, they do it's a lot of setup work to do that. So they want to do a batch of flatheads. They want to do a batch of, you know, big block Mopars. Oh, they want to do a batch of LS all at once. So they kind of wait to get enough of those to make it worth their time to do all the setup.
Yeah, right.
And it was fine. I did not need the engine anytime soon. I still really don't need it until I get the body painted. So it's going to sit on the, under the bench for a little while.
It was 65 out yesterday. You could have painted it yesterday.
Yeah, I should have. I'm so close. But anyway, that's my story. I'm probably boring everybody.
No.
It's a car
People love to hear about, you know, this weird shit on this yeah. show.
Nice. I don't think well, we can get anyone. In the weeds if you want.
We specialize in tangents and divergences.
Yeah, there's...
Perfect. Then you can hear all about flatheads and mechanical brakes.
Awesome. All right. Well, Robbie, tell us what you drove this week.
So I drove something but didn't go anywhere. It's like one of those riddles, like from the Riddler, or I don't know. You're annoying.
So you just like sat there and did burnouts, you know, on a drag strip.
I didn't move at all. I flew to Poland, where I went to the ITS Motor Transport Institute for Autonomous Vehicles Competence Center for Poland. Their idea is that they want to make sure that when people or companies deploy autonomous vehicles in Poland, that they work. Which is, you know.
Seemed like a reasonable goal.
Yeah, it seems like something you should be doing. You should make sure that when you deploy something, it works. I know that's hard for a lot of companies, but
at least for one particular company.
At least for one. So I flew there, and one of their deals is they set up scenarios and really difficult. They record scenarios in difficult intersections so they can give them to automakers or companies who want to deploy autonomous vehicles in their country to help them train those systems. And they also work to see how humans and vehicles interact. And one of the ways they do that is they have two simulators. They have one for large trucks, semi-trucks, and they have one for just vehicles, regular old cars. I could have driven the regular old car. No.
So why would you do that?
Yeah, anyone can drive a regular old car. So instead, what I did is I drove the giant truck. And when I got in the truck, I was the first one, because I'm always the first to raise my hand for anything. They threw all the scenarios at me. The woman who's in charge of the technology division of that, who runs all the sort of nerdy things. I also made a joke that, oh yeah, throw everything at me, including a plane landing. So I got in a big semi, and it's just like I have to turn off the part, you know, the air brake, and I have to put it in gear, I have to turn it on, all this stuff, or it won't work. So I'm driving it, and immediately I'm going through a tunnel, and as I come out of the tunnel, she just turns on like a windstorm. So I come out of the tunnel, so blah! It was not windy before I went into the tunnel, it wasn't rainy. Suddenly, so now I'm like trying not to hit the divider, which fortunately I was able to not wreck the fake semi-truck that I was driving. I drove a little
while. Would you get fake points on your license if you did?
I think so. Like on my fake license. So
yeah. But fake license, basically international driving license.
Yeah, the international driving permit that we get from AAA. I drove a little bit longer. She stuck a trailer alongside, you know, on the exit ramp. So I had to go around that in a very thin area. Then she just had a moose come out that apparently no one else saw but me, thankfully, because I was driving. Slowed down, went around a moose, took a left turn. Suddenly a man appeared in the road. Kept driving. She had cars braking. And so she's doing all, you know, throwing all these scenarios at me. And then she's like, hold on. I'm like, okay. And all of a sudden the simulation goes dark. And then boom, it comes back. She's like, turn off the vehicle. I'm like, okay. Goes dark. Comes back up. I'm on a flight line. And there's a plane coming at me. So now I go, oh my God, I'm trying to turn the vehicle on. And I got out of the way just in time before the, and I was driving a shell truck. So anyway, so they use it to measure, you know, competence in driving, and scenarios, and just determine like how people react to scenarios like that. Like, again, like a moose coming out and you know, running out in front of you.
Or a person, guy sleeping in the middle of the interstate or something.
Yeah, a man
apparently.
Sleeping in the interstate, yeah. Or a train, or you know, a 747 barreling down on you as you wake up from some sort of coma in a gas truck. So it was interesting, and you know, they she would
she was very, she's like, this is really, you know, for us, this part is really the interaction of how people interact with their vehicles. And they do a lot of drowsy driving research there. And they talked about, you know, everyone's eyes are different. So, you know, it's hard to create, you know, sort of a catch-all for drowsy driving, because, you know, everyone opens their eyes a little bit differently than everyone else. And of course, everyone's tall, short, whatever. And you know, what happens when, you know, you create scenarios. And what was funny is she talked about how they had a local morning news, you know, morning news, and they have the tech guy go out, and they were going to have a scenario where they told him they were going to have someone stop short in front of him, if he, while he was looking at his phone. And he's like, well, it's not going to work because I know it's coming. And she's like, well, we'll see. And of course, he slammed into the car in front of him. Like, he just looked at his phone for a second. She braked the car in front of him, and he just ran right into it. So even with anticipation, the idea of, like, when you're looking at your phone, it distracts you just enough where you could, you know, there could be a horrible, you know, outcome. So don't look at your phone while you're driving, is what I'm trying to tell you. And even when you're anticipating it, that a scientist is going to when you know it's going to happen, you're still going to hit the thing. So yeah, no, it was very interesting. I'll have a couple articles coming up on SAE about it. It was, you know, the whole trip that I, you know, the reason I went to Poland was to sort of, you know, talk to their overarching, it's called PGM, their Polish Automotive, group, where they work with all these sort of small suppliers to help them interact or work with, larger OEMs outside of the company. And, you know, we went to a company that refurbishes large calipers for trucks, for large trucks, you know, again, semis, you know, class 8 vehicles. And that was really interesting. We did some of the autonomous stuff, and this was really sort of an institute. They get some money from companies, but they make a lot of their money by making sure vehicles are homologated for Poland. So they do, you know, that's how they make their money, in order to think, so they can do the research for, you know, autonomous driving. And, you know, we all, I think everyone listens has heard me go on and on about how autonomous driving is still very far away. Like, true autonomous driving is not an easy problem to solve. But I think talking to these folks, for them, it's more about safety, you know, driver and pedestrian and, you know, cyclist safety, and making sure it works within their infrastructure, versus like, the like, we got to get it there as quick as possible for shareholder value, which of course has never worked out. No matter how many, it's weird. We just keep doing it. It doesn't work. I don't know why.
Funny that. But like, six people make a whole bunch of money though.
Well, I would argue that, you know, if your goal is to maximize shareholder value, then it has worked out remarkably well for Tesla. Because, I mean, the entire premise of their shareholder value, you know, their market cap, is based on the trillions of dollars a year that they're going to make from robotaxis any minute now.
Mm-hmm. Any minute.
You know, well, I mean, if you take that out of the equation, Tesla would have a shareholder value, you know, maybe, you know, $10, $15 billion, you know, equivalent to, you know, any other automaker that sells, you know, 1.5 to 2 million cars a year. It would not have, you know, $1 trillion+ valuation. So it
has
worked
robots
for
too.
Yeah, it has worked for shareholder value.
They're
going to come out with that Roadster like 7 years ago.
Yeah,
so, like,
I mean, a Tesla is a you know, it's a meme stock. Its value is not set to anything that's real. But it has intrinsic value because it has intrinsic value. It's like NFTs. Remember NFTs or the monkeys? Remember the monkeys? Or Beanie Babies, like, they had value because they had value, and just because everyone,
because
just
people thought it had value.
Yeah,
but,
so everyone,
I mean, to just some degree, every stock is like that.
Yeah, everything has value because it. But there's the, if you look at what's backing up the value of that stock, it's not in reality. I mean, in the stock, and also the stock market is not a real thing most of the time.
Yeah,
I worked
these days is just a casino.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all cover tech, and a thousand, you know, the death of 1,000 unicorns, like companies that were worth, you know, billions of dollars that didn't really have a business plan or an actual product that more than, you know, 20,000 people who didn't know how to, like, do their own, you know, laundry.
No, we're going to disrupt the kitchen utensil industry.
Yeah, we're going to make a juicer.
Changing
yeah.
new.
Here's a $700 juicer that's really yeah. just squeezing juice that's already been squeezed.
Correct.
I mean, correct. I know I certainly need a humanoid robot to load the dishes into my dishwasher. Yeah, you because know, I cannot take 30 seconds to do that on my own.
Oh, no. You're too busy, Sam.
Oh, you've
got to edit this show, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The show would never get out if I didn't have a humanoid robot to load the dishwasher.
Which is such a 20.
Did you guys see the clip of the one robot? The guy, I forget the guy. He has a YouTube channel. He bought some robot, and he was trying to have it cook eggs in the kitchen.
No.
It's just a complete disaster. I forget the guy's name.
I'd be terrified. Like, fire. That's the only reason I'd be terrified. Like, everything else.
The robot spilled the eggs, and then it slipped on the eggs, and it's trying to catch itself, and then it falls over, and it makes just a colossal mess.
So it's Mr.
Hilarious if you haven't seen it.
The robot is Mr. Bean.
I'll have to look for that one, but I did see a clip from a Russian company that brought out their first robot the other day. And came out onto the stage and immediately face planted. And then everybody's trying to pull curtains around it.
They had this black fabric they brought out to try and hide it.
Yeah.
And it was twisted in the middle, so it couldn't block anything.
I don't understand the desire for the humanoid robot outside of, you know, because we all watch the Jetsons. Because
that's pretty much it, I think.
Yeah, I think there's... It's like the flying car. I remember for a couple of years, they're going to have a flying car. I'm like, well, first of all, flying cars don't exist. Because a car and a flying machine are two, you know, very different things. And you've driven on the road as a listener. You know how those people are. Do you want to be in the sky with those folks?
No.
I mean, there's a reason the FAA has, like, you know, pilot's license. And,
it'll be autonomous.
But it's still, at the end of the day, it's still just a very nice helicopter. It's a helicopter with redundancies, which I'm like, okay, cool. Just say that's what it is. It's eVTOL. It's a helicopter with redundancies. Fine. Don't call it a flying car. For the love of Pete.
You know, if it flies, it's also not a car. It's an aircraft.
Exactly. Flying car. Stop it.
It may be a drivable aircraft, but it's not a flying car.
Mm-hmm. Like, no one's driving their Ford Escort and then taking off at the local airport to land at LAX.
And if you've ever seen one of these eVTOLs, these things are, I mean, if you think a Hummer EV is large, you know, or a heavy duty pickup truck, these things are huge. They're enormous. Massive. There is no way that they could ever drive.
Yeah. Knocking over signs.
Yeah.
It's like... when they move the Challenger through a town for them to land and take off, they have to uproot trees and move traffic signs when they move one of the space shuttles through LA. Yeah. They had essentially take apart the infrastructure so it could go through town. It's like that. If you want something that carries more than two people, mm-hmm. and even when they
well, you get the Cadillac one that was just like a wheelchair that was with a bunch of fans on it, right?
Yeah,
that seems. Yeah, it's a little. Yeah,
and it was still huge.
It's still very, very large. So, anyway, no flying cars.
So back to the simulator. Was this a full motion dynamic simulator that moved around so you feel the forces?
It did. It moved around. The brakes were a little. They didn't, and they were very upfront about it. The brakes are not like one to one with the physics of a loaded. Semi, because they're like that's not really the point right now. The point is like how people react to things. So you would stop short. So you actually you had the advantage, but apparently most people don't see the moose because you're coming at you're going by the trees, and the person in the simulator with me who was like watching just sitting there. I'm like, oh, moose, and I slowed down and went around the moose. He's like, I didn't even see the moose until it was too late. So. Yeah, so it's...
Having encountered moose, you know, on the road in northern Sweden many years ago, you know, I mean, the only reason I didn't hit the moose is because I was far enough away from it. You know, it was actually two moose that came running out of the trees on one side.
It's like a tree just decided to move.
Yeah, they came running out of the trees on one side of the road, ran across the road, And, you know, the, like I said, the only reason I didn't hit them is because I was far enough away when I saw them. But, you know, if I had been closer, I mean, there's no way I could have averted them.
Yeah, no, they just sort of, they're so, and you're like, well, they're so big, but they're the same color as trees, man. Because mm-hmm. they're trying to hide from wolves. And then suddenly one of the trees is like, hey, I'm in the road.
And their legs and their antlers are like trees. You know, it looks like a tree trunk.
It looks like a tree. And even the little flying squirrel friend that they always have with them, they don't help because they're so small.
Yeah. It's hard to see those little squirrels.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So are they, they're also making this simulator available for AV companies that want to test on scenarios recorded from Polish roads? Is that also what they're doing there?
You know, I think they would do it loud. They understand that they're still pretty early days with this, and they understand that, you know, AVs are still pretty far off. I mean, really, we have one level 3 vehicle on the road. And it's, you know, it's Geofence, the S class, the Mercedes S class. And then we have GM coming in like 2 or 3 years. I was at the event. They said the year like 15 times and I still can't remember it because I'd only got
2028.
Like, yeah. 2020. Cause I'd only gotten like 90 minutes of sleep before I got to the event after driving in the desert all day. 2028. So it, you know, it's good to be prepared for this sort of, or for this technology in a way that benefits the people on your roads. That, and you know, and again, I mean, Mercedes drove around, they did a whole big deal where they drove around the world just to collect data from every region of the world and how people drive and how, you know, the, you know, local laws and line markings and signs and, you know, just the weird little, you know, the colloquial driving experience of driving in Japan versus driving in China versus driving in India versus driving in Detroit versus driving in, you know, North Carolina. Every place is different. And there's so many variables that these companies have to think about. And if you go into a region, it's helpful at that region if someone in that region has already thought about that and already set up something so that when you as a company, you come into that region, they have data, they have training information, and they have simulators that allow you to, like, at least, you know, get a sort of a head start. So they're not starting from zero in order to have autonomous vehicles in that region.
Yeah, because, you know, every place you go has got different rules of the roads, different road configurations. You know, some places have roundabouts, some places don't. You know, here in Michigan, we've got Michigan left turns, you know, which are a weird kind of anomaly.
Australia, they have that weird turn that you go to the right and then you take a left, or a very weird turn in Australia. You know,
we have some of that here. You know, that's one of the varieties that we have here in Michigan, where, you know, especially for major thoroughfares, you know, instead of making a direct left turn at an intersection, you will turn right and then immediately go into a lane and do a U-turn to go back in the opposite direction. You know, and in some cases, you go through the intersection and do the U-turn and then come back and make the right turn at the intersection. Mm-hmm. And you know, some vehicles, you know, that try to rely on cameras only for automated driving have difficulty with that.
They
brand might that be? I can't imagine.
So they talked, you know, they're you know, they have four LiDAR, 6 radar, a bunch of cameras on these devices, on their sort of test vehicles. They have one test vehicle that has, you know, that's kind of going out. And they didn't talk, they just said, well, some companies do, you know, camera only, and, you know, a lot of people have, you know, various opinions about that, which is, you know, sort of corporate speak for that's dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, they're not a corporation. They're you know, they're part, you know, they get funding from the government and from, you know, homologation, you know, certification. So, you know, at some point they're going to have to work with, well, maybe, who knows? But at some point, you know, they're going to have to work with some company that's probably going to want to try to come in with camera only, autonomous driving. And so, but it you know, when you talk to actual researchers in this and people who've been following this, camera only is always sort of like, you want to do what? Ah, man. I mean, I guess it's like the robot making, eggs, but it doesn't have the correct skillet. And it's got to use like a wooden spoon instead of like a spatula. You're like, this is what we got to do.
Yeah, just not quite the right equipment.
Just not quite. It's like one piece of the equipment. You got a pan and then it just falls apart.
Excellent. All right. Anything else on the Polish simulator?
Quick, running through my notes. No, I'm going to say no because there's just too much. Oh, I'm looking at the wrong. And I'm looking at the wrong. at the wrong notes. Because I changed over for something. Yeah, they're testing scenarios. Let me make sure. 6 radars, 4 LIDARs.
That's a reasonable configuration.
Yeah, and then a bunch, a gaggle of cameras. Oh, and a thermal camera as well.
Just keep at, what other sensors are we missing here?
They had the high, high
microphones.
Quality. AM, they did, they had a microphone in the back. Something, I don't know.
Like the Mercedes system where it has the microphone so it can hear emergency vehicles. They had a microphone on there for emergency vehicles. They have the high definition GPS. They didn't talk about it, but they had it.
Needs an altimeter.
Altimeter.
Just in case. I don't know why.
Barometer.
They should have one, a barometer. Yeah.
Barometer. Yeah.
And of course, you know, a 6-axis motion sensor.
Yep. Oh, yeah. There's
no, we need a barometer before we need that.
We need you think it's good? Ooh, it's chilly. Is it going to rain?
It's gonna rain.
It's the barometric pressure. No driving today. Too much pressure.
And it has an integrated blood pressure cuff.
Yeah.
Just in case.
It's squeezing your arm the entire time.
We're just talking about the external sensors. I mean, then there's all the internal sensors. You know, you need multiple cameras watching the driver and all the vehicle occupants. You need to measure the driver's heart rate and respiration rate, and their blood pressure.
They just put little sensors up your nose to check
if they start to get a little anxious.
Your oxygen levels.
Oh, and blood sugar. Don't forget blood sugar.
You
got to have a continuous glucose monitor in the car. You know, so if they haven't eaten enough Snickers.
Peckish.
You know, yeah.
You got the peckish monitor. Oh, you seem a little peckish. Just pull over and get you something nice. Here's a banana.
It's like an Acura first drive event. You'll have a little bag of snacks in the back. I just ate 20 minutes ago, but thank God there's a bag of chips. And a Cliff Bar in the back seat.
A very interesting thing about Poland is everywhere you go when you get there, there's always a plate of at least cookies. And then they have like little sandwiches and little meats and whatever. So we would see like 2 to 4 companies a day while we were there. It was a whirlwind event. The sun goes down at like 3 o'clock. And so I'm like, well, that was the end of the day. But everywhere you went, there was like cookies and candy and, you know, something else. And so,
They didn't want you to get hangry at all.
And they're like,
especially, you know, after they made you fly coach from San Francisco.
Yeah, that was another thing. But, you know, complaining about getting a flight to Poland is, that's a whole other audience. I try to real people, like regular normal humans.
You don't want to come across sounding as too entitled.
Yes, you sound very entitled when you're like, oh, I had to fly coach flying to Poland instead of business class. And there's a lot of reasons why that's not a great idea, especially if you have a drive program. But I wasn't doing a drive. I was just in offices and doing tours and watching, you know, machines and driving simulators. I wasn't driving a car, so it wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, when I flew to Austria this year, that doesn't matter. I flew to Austria to ride motorcycles. They gave me a whole extra day because riding a motorcycle is far more, you know, cognitive, you know, it's more intense than driving a car. So they gave me a whole, so I just had a free day. I walked around, I went hiking, I saw a goat. I didn't need that in Poland. I wasn't going on any of that stuff.
No. How many days were you in Poland?
We got there. I left on Monday and got back on yesterday afternoon.
Okay.
So Saturday.
So a decent amount of time then. Yeah.
I was there for, it was 3 days of nonstop meetings and tours. So
that's a lot. You covered a lot.
Yeah. So I got a lot of notes
to check out those articles when they come out.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll check them out. They're very, it was a nice time. I had a lot of meat and potatoes and dumplings.
So very, very Eastern European.
And cookies and small sandwiches, too.
Let's don't tell Poland they're Eastern European. They are Central European.
Okay.
That is a whole thing I found out while I was there.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, they hate Putin.
I don't blame them. Yeah. They have rather a history with Russia.
Yeah, Russia. They hate Russia, and
Yeah. The Russians have been there a few times.
Yeah, they're not fans.
No. I can't say I would be either, but...
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. All right. Well, I had a Kia EV6 again. I had the 2025 EV6 GT line. So, this is, for 2025, Kia did a mid-cycle update of the EV6, just as Hyundai did with the Ioniq 5, which means that it got some mild visual refreshes to the exterior, new lights in the front, some other minor tweaks. And probably the most important tweak of all was they moved the charging port from the right rear corner to the left rear corner and changed it from a CCS1 port to a SAJ3400 port, also known as a NACS or Tesla port. They also upgraded the battery. They bumped the battery up from 77 kilowatt hours to 84 kilowatt hours. But overall performance is about the same, got a little bit more range than before. And, this meant we had two EV6s here this week because we also own one. We own a 2023 EV6 Wind with
the NACTOY edition?
Not the NACTOY edition, no. So we have a Wind with dual motor all-wheel drive. So it's the same motors on there, 320 horsepower between the two motors, slightly rear biased. The rear motor is a little more powerful. The GT line is not the GT, the EV6 GT.
So confusing and for no reason.
Arguably, the GT line is better because it costs a lot less and delivers basically
the performance you actually need.
Yeah, you don't need the GT model. And you get more range too, right?
Because it's not quite as hard more range.
You get more range with the GT.
Yeah. Question for the August panel here, though. You mentioned they moved the charging port from one side to the other. Where do you guys think the charging port should go on EVs? I'm curious.
I believe it should be in the front because there's still a lot of charging out in the world, including Tesla charging. That's it's in parking lots, and every time someone has to back in, you're like, oh, it's when you're pulling into the Costco parking lot, and the guy in the Silverado decides to back his truck in. It makes sense. It's easier when you have a large truck to back it in. But you're like, oh, I got to wait 30 seconds for this guy. Now you got to do that. Yeah, it's when you just pull straight in, poop, 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 plop, plug it in.
I personally don't really have much of a preference one way or the other. I think the front having it in the front panel actually generally works pretty well everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's easily accessible regardless of where the charger is configured. Like if you get a Genesis GV70 or G80 EV, they have the charge port in the now fake grill.
Yeah.
And so you can pull up to a Tesla supercharger, that has ridiculously short cables and still reach that port. In the case of the EV6, on the Ioniq 5, they did not move the charge port. Because on the Ioniq 5, where the charge port is located is actually in the sheet metal in the right rear corner. And so they would have had to retool that sheet metal, that metal panel and everything. In the case of the EV6, the charge port is, you have the tail lamps that curve, run across and curve down the sides. And there's a plastic trim panel below that. And so all they had to do was change the plastic panel and, of course, change the wiring harness. So it was a lot easier for Kia to move the charging port to the left rear corner so that it's in the same place as it is on Tesla vehicles, which means you do have to back in to charge at a supercharger, but you don't have, you can park in the correct parking space because of the way they're set up. Uh-huh. So you're not taking up an extra parking space in order to reach the cable. The press car that they delivered did have the charging adapters that came with it. Kia does not actually bundle those with the car. You have to pay extra for those. So the AC adapter, I think, is about $100 or so, $125.
So if you've got the J plug at home, for instance, for your level 2 charger, you've got to buy the adapter.
Right.
The car's coming with NACS. Yeah.
And actually, I was just looking on Amazon this morning for one of those because tomorrow I'm getting a Lucid Gravity, and I'm not sure if that one's going to come with an adapter or not.
For the price, it damn well better.
Well, should we give them the $200 adapter?
Well,
our 80-something-thousand-dollar car.
The AC adapters are actually fairly inexpensive. You can get those for about $30 to $40.
Yeah.
The DC adapters are more expensive because they have to have more stuff in them, you know, for temperature monitoring, things like that, because of the higher power outputs. You know, driving this, you know, the interior is basically unchanged, except for they changed some of the textures on some of the surfaces. I like the layout of the EV6 with one distinct exception. In recent years, Kias have had this panel below the center part of the dashboard, which is a dual mode panel that, you know, has a couple of knobs on it. And if you tap one of the icons on there, it will give you media controls. So you turn the knob and it changes the volume or changes the tuner. And there's a couple other things on there. And you tap the other icon on there and it changes it over to climate controls. So those knobs go from becoming volume and tuner to the temperature controls. Mm-hmm. And the first time I ever drove an EV6, it was on the temperature control mode.
How do I change the radio station?
I couldn't figure out how to change the volume with the knob. I mean, there is a redundant volume control on the steering wheel, but that's still somewhat of an annoyance.
It's a good use of space, and it's no different than the menu bar on your Mac, right? It changes based on what program you're using.
Yeah, so it's a clever idea that is perhaps more clever than useful.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, that's a lot of EV stuff. It's clever for the sake of being clever, and you're like, stop mm-hmm. it, stop.
That's stop. What I like about the Lightning, for instance. It's just an F-150.
Yeah, it's just an F-150.
You just plug it in and you go and drive it.
That's what I liked about our Kona Electric. It's just the Kona, but electric.
Yeah. It doesn't try to be something it's not.
It's like, look what I'm doing. No, none of that.
So, you know, otherwise, you know, the EV6 and the Ioniq 5 and the Ioniq 6, you know, are all mechanically identical to each other. EV6 is a slightly shorter wheelbase, but, you know, it's a different shape to it. I personally prefer the shape of the EV6, but I'm fine with the Ioniq 5 as well. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why my wife and I bought an EV6, because we like the way it looks. It's a great car to drive, quick enough. You know, with the 320 horsepower, it'll do 0-60 in the low 4-second range. You know, it's got decent handling. It's roomy. You know, carry five people easily. It's got plenty of cargo space in the back. You know, during the summer, you know, we loaded up the paddleboard and beach chairs and stuff, and the dog went out to the lake.
Nice.
So it's a very useful vehicle. It's a nice size vehicle, and it's the reason why I spent our money on this thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we think it's
you
bought it twice. Yes.
Yeah. Car's so nice, you bought it twice.
Yeah.
There you go. The advertising writes itself. But like the Hyundai Motor Group did a fantastic job with that EGMP architecture, which they've just expanded everywhere, right? But it charges very quickly with the battery design, great performance, excellent refinement. I mean, lots of room, like you said, Sam. Super versatile vehicles too. So like, it's hard to fault any of those products, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to be nitpicky, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, there's not many EVs, you know, that will charge at, you know, upwards of 240 kilowatts and keep charging at that speed for most of the charging cycle. Like, it'll stay above 200 kilowatts well past 50% state of charge.
Wow.
You know, I have seen, you know, even at, you know, 70% state of charge, still going 170 kilowatts, you know, which is why you can get from 10 to 80% charge in 18 minutes with these things.
I've driven my Ioniq 5 up and down the state a bunch of times, and it charges quicker than it takes for me to eat a burrito from like below 20%. I'm just like, ah. So sometimes, even if it's 80%, I'm still eating my burrito and there's no one around, I'll just keep eating.
You'll be that guy.
I'll just be that guy. Well, if I see someone.
Yeah, if somebody's like, waiting, okay, to use the charger.
If someone's waiting, I'm going to leave at 80%. Good, I'm not going to be that jerk. But if I'm eating my burrito.
Don't be the Chevy Bolt driver that takes the only 350 kilowatt charger. And you're there for 2 days because you got to, for some reason you feel you have to go to 100%. No, don't do that.
I've encountered that person at my local Electrify America station.
Oh, yes. And they're sitting there for like 3 hours. Or I don't know if it's 3 hours. A really long time.
A very long time.
Because the car does, 55 kilowatts or something?
Yeah, well, it depends. The original ones were 50, and then they bumped it up to a whole 55.
Yeah.
The new one that's coming out after the first of the year is 150. But
yeah, okay, that's pretty much the standard, right?
Yeah.
These days.
So, you know, obviously now the tax credits on EVs have gone away. But what we are seeing is that a lot of manufacturers have made adjustments to compensate for the absence of the tax credits. The Hyundai crew, you know, cut the price of the Ioniq 5 by an average of over $9,100. They cut the MSRP. Mm-hmm. Kia has not yet cut the MSRP of their EVs. But they are offering some pretty spectacular deals. Like I took a look, you know, when I first checked a few weeks ago, you know, they were offering $9,000 rebates on the EV6 and the EV9. That is now at $10,000, but that's only if you finance the car through Kia Financial America. So they'll give you $10,000 off. So the EV6 GT line, the Neroni for the one that I've got here in the driveway, came to a grand total of $60,740. And so if you go to a Kia dealer and you finance it through Kia, you can get $10,000 off of that. And then some dealers are also offering additional discounts on top of that. So you can conceivably get one of these, you know, in the upper 40s. You know, if you don't need the GT line, yeah, so look, you know, comparing the GT line to ours, we have the Wind. You know, some of the things that are that we don't have on ours, we don't have the heads up display. That's fine, we can live without that. We don't have the glass moonroof. That's fine. Solid steel roof is fine with me.
I hate moonroofs.
We've had moonroofs on several on our last several cars, but you know, when it came around this time, it's like in recent years, my wife hasn't really used it anyway. So it was no big deal not having it. The GT line comes with 20-inch alloy wheels. You know, our Wind has 19s, which arguably living in someplace like Michigan is better because you get a little more sidewall, which, you know, makes the tires a little more resilient to pothole damage.
And for all of the car designers listening, stop putting such big wheels on everything.
Yeah.
Smaller is fine. To your point, Sam, you won't damage the wheels if you live in a place where the roads are bomb cratered. Also, ride and handling is way better, like the Silverado EV. Have you driven that thing with the 24s?
I have.
It's terrible.
It was not good.
It was not good. No. Unlike whatever the what's the Trail Boss model? I think it comes with like 18s or 19s.
Yeah, 18s. I've got a Trail Boss coming in a few weeks.
Better.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Better.
Definitely.
You put the 24s on there, it just destroys it. I'm sorry. That's my little aside here.
The GT line also gets a heat pump instead of a resistive heater, which, you know, is a little bit better in cold weather for efficiency. And you get heated rear seats in addition to the heated and cooled front seats. But, you know, the Wind also has heated and ventilated front seats. Who cares if your rear seats are heated? You know, let the plebs in the back, you know, suffer a little.
That's
bit.
That's where my dog sits, so they're fine yeah. without the heated seats.
And then, you know, the current on the 25s, the GT line gets a heated steering wheel. The Wind does not. Our 23 Wind does have a heated steering wheel. So, you know, they did take, you know, remove a couple of things, moved a couple of things around, did some repackaging, but overall, you know, they're pretty similar in the most important ways. So,
but a 10 grand discount, that's
yeah.
huge. Are yeah, they making so, any money at that point? Is this a loss leader?
Probably not.
I have asked, well, previous to this, I have asked Hyundai, I'm like, so do you lose money or do you make money on each car? They're like, why would we lose money?
They're not going to answer that.
We make money on our cars. They told me, they're like, we yeah. make oh, money. They, we make a profit on our vehicles. Why would, okay. what are you talking about? What's wrong with you? Why would you ask that question? Yeah, why would we make a car if this
They've consistently
money?
Said that these vehicles are profitable. Of course, that's, you know, profitable at the original MSRP. What, are they still profitable if they're giving you 10 grand off?
Who knows? Or maybe they're mega profitable. Maybe
their overall lineup averaged out is profitable, but perhaps they're still losing money.
No. They have explicitly said their EVs are profitable.
Yeah. Okay.
So
up until now, we know they're profitable. Who knows what's in the future?
So Craig, since this is your first time on the show, one of our things that we do here is we have a little contest when we do the car reviews of guess the destination charge.
Okay.
1200.
What was yours, Robbie?
1200. I'm just yelling okay. things.
What's your guess?
I'm trying to remember what Hyundai Kia does. It's either like 1295 or 1495, I think. I'm going to go 1295. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Well, you won. It's actually 1475.
See, what? You're a winner.
Wow. It's just a way for automakers to make another $1,000 or more.
Especially well, it American certainly is for the Detroit automakers.
Yes.
On the full-size trucks and utilities, we've talked about this before, they have raised the destination charges twice this year by $600. They went from, at the beginning of the year, it was $19.95, then they went to $21.95, and more recently they went to $25.95.
It's $2,600?
It is $2,600 on a full-size truck or SUV now. Yeah.
No, I'll go to the factory and pick it up myself, thanks.
Well, you're still going to pay the $2,600.
I know, it's the unfortunate part.
We've had this conversation way too many times. So that's the 2025 EV6 GT line, all-wheel drive.
Nice.
All right, let's get into some of the other stuff. So this week, Kia took the wraps off of, well, they showed us the visuals of the new 2027 Telluride. They are going to officially unveil it completely on Thursday at the LA Auto Show. I don't know. Are you going to LA, Craig?
I'm not.
Are you, Robbie?
I'm sorry.
Nope. I have time off. I actually have time off. Am I going to LA? And it looks like I'm not
going
to CES either. I'm skipping all the, I do all the weird little things like Poland and Austria. And
that sounds more fun than CES, I'll be honest.
We'll miss you in Vegas.
We'll see. I mean, someone might still like sneak up on me and be like, hey, can you...
You might get hornswoggled into going. Just gird up your loins.
I've been to CES. I've only missed one CES in like the last 20 years. That wasn't like, you know, pandemic. And so if I don't go to CES, I'll be... it's not going to hurt my feelings.
So anyway, the Telluride, the 27 Telluride... You know, obviously rides as before on the same platform as the Hyundai Palisade. Mm-hmm. Kia did an event in Los Angeles, I think a week and a half ago, at their design center.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought some people in to take a look at this. I was not among that group. Did you go to
I
that,
was
Robbie?
There.
I went to
you
it.
You were there?
Yeah, we okay. were there. I mean, cool people were there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know. so what did you guys think of the new Telluride?
Okay.
It doesn't look better, I don't think, on the outside at least.
It looks better in pictures. It looks better in person than in pictures, but that doesn't mean it's not as nice. The previous design was better.
Yeah, there exterior-wise, at least. Yeah, they made it larger. It's a couple inches longer. The wheelbase is extended a little bit as well. So there should be a good bit more passenger space in the third row, easier access back there as well. The interior of the Telluride looks fantastic. But the exterior, I don't know why. it's missing something.
It's definitely blockier.
Yeah.
And they said they wanted it blockier. They're like, because they're like, well, you know, old SUVs, old, you know, competent SUVs are blocky. They're big blocky machines. So we made a big blocky machine. And they're like, okay, that's what you did. And they, you know, they showed us the X Pro. That's what their whole, you know, the sort of off-roadish version of the vehicle. So. Yeah.
Yeah, which looks particularly Spartan up front. I'm hoping some of the more mass market trims, more mainstream trims, will have a little different treatment up front. But the X Pro model, it looks a little bare up front.
From the images that they released, the more mainstream trims actually look even more Spartan, because you don't even have, like, on the X Pro you have the
blinds.
Are they orange or red recovery hooks? So you at least have that. You don't have that on the mainstream model. I like the current Telluride. I'm somewhat less enamored with this one. It's interesting. I mean, the interior, like you said, does look really nice, but the exterior, I'm not a huge fan of.
Again, it looks better in person than it does in the pictures.
Okay.
But it's not as good as the previous generation. And also, you know, I was talking to someone about this. What we like as automotive journalists doesn't always translate to what people buy.
That's so true.
Definitely not.
It's like, yeah. Sometimes the auto journalists get a very, very large heads about, like, well, this is what I think. Rough. Like, we love this car. No one buys the car.
Yeah.
We hate this car. 70 million of that version.
Cadillac CTS-V wagon, you know.
Yeah.
With a manual.
Like, yeah. Any wagon. Yeah. We're like, yeah. And the consumers are like, meh.
Well, I mean, the first generation Telluride and Palisade, you know, I think a lot of people preferred, or a lot of journalists at least, preferred the look of the Telluride to the Palisade.
Yes.
But the Palisade sold significantly higher volumes than the Telluride. So
again, crazy. Because the Palisade look, you know, the Telluride worked better, but you know, we can't control.
But I guess they didn't tell you guys any technical details.
Nah, they didn't tell us nothing.
I mean, we can go to HyundaiNews.com.
Yeah, right? Just read the spec sheet for the Palisade.
I'm assuming it's going to be the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Palisade has 3.5 liter naturally aspirated V6 with, I think, about 268 horsepower, which, definitely feels a little underwhelming in that vehicle. And then,
wasn't it a 3.8 before?
It was a 3.8 before, yeah. So the new one is slightly smaller, but the vehicle is bigger and heavier. I think it's close to the same power as before, maybe just slightly less, but the vehicle's bigger and heavier. So I would expect the same experience, you know, in the Telluride. And then, you know, the other thing that we would expect in the Telluride is the hybrid, the next gen Hyundai Motor Group hybrid system, which I got a chance to drive a week or so ago in the Palisade. You know, we went to Austin, Texas to drive the new Palisade. The hybrid system's really good. It feels much better than the naturally aspirated V6. It has a 2.5 liter turbo 4-cylinder, and it's a different hybrid configuration from the previous Hyundai Motor Group hybrids. Hyundai had kind of an odd, unusual, unique hybrid configuration. So they used a combination of an electric motor that was embedded in the six-speed automatic transmission, and a clutch between the engine and the electric motor. So the electric motor took the place of the torque converter. And then they also had a belted starter generator, which handled the starting and stopping of the engine, did a little bit of energy recovery, a little bit of the regen. Most of the regen was handled by the electric motor and the transmission. And so driving it, it felt more normal, natural, more like a conventional vehicle because it had a conventional transmission in there. But it didn't have as much electrical power as some other hybrid systems. So the new one, they get rid of the belted starter generator, and they added a second motor generator unit in the transmission. So now you have the engine, the first motor generator, the clutch, and then the second motor generator. And the second motor is the one that does most of the propulsion. So when you're driving along.
So that's on the input shaft of the transmission.
It's on the input shaft of the transmission.
With no clutch.
With no clutch, correct.
Okay.
And then the first motor generator, it's on the output shaft of the crank. It's on the output of the crankshaft of the engine. And that the clutch is in between those two. And so when the clutch is open, then the system basically operates like a series hybrid. So the engine can, if you need the power, if the battery is depleted, I mean, it's just, smallish 1.5 kilowatt hour battery, similar, typical of a hybrid. So the engine is going to be driving that first motor generator, providing electricity to the battery, which then the second motor generator uses to move the vehicle. And that's, low to mid speed range. And then when at higher speeds, that clutch closes and it operates as a parallel hybrid with the engine and both motors driving the vehicle. And it definitely feels a lot better. It's 332 horsepower. Let's say 336 foot-pounds of torque, I think. Something like that. And so we don't know the we don't know for certain that that's what's going to be in the Telluride, but it's going to be in the Telluride.
It's going to be in the Telluride. Yeah. So this whole system is completely different from what Ford and Toyota have done for patent reasons, right? Because Ford and Toyota came to some sort of agreement, some patent sharing deal. I think they may have had some money changing hands as well many years ago. Mm-hmm. But basically their hybrid systems are the same with the planetary gear set and the two motor generators. This is totally different then.
Yeah, because it uses a conventional 6-speed step ratio, planetary gear set automatic transmission.
Yeah, but still pretty efficient and effective, it sounds like. So
yeah, driving the Palisade, we were in the Palisade calligraphy, which is the top trim level with the two large wheels, the 20 or 21 inch, or maybe it was 22 inch wheels even. And that one, we averaged, it's rated at 29 miles per gallon combined, with all wheel drive on the calligraphy. And we saw an indicated 28. We didn't get a chance to fill it up and do a formal, but during our drive, for about 4 hours,
very impressive, though.
We saw 28 miles per gallon with it, which is, quite good actually. And the base front wheel drive model with the 18 inch wheels is rated at 34 miles per gallon combined. So
see,
that's
those smaller wheels.
Yeah. So that's, that's comparable to what you get with a Toyota Highlander hybrid, which is a fair bit smaller vehicle. The Highlander, is technically a 3-row, but the third row is very small. The third row in the Palisade and in the Telluride is much more usable for adults. So I think this hybrid system definitely seems to work really well. It's very smooth. You don't really notice the transitions at all between the series and parallel and EV modes. It just kind of all works seamlessly. There's no jerking or anything. And because it's got a 6-speed transmission, it also feels more natural. It doesn't have the droning you get with a Toyota or Ford hybrid system where when you accelerate, it revs up to 4,000 RPM and then just sits there. Uh-huh. It's a much more pleasant experience to drive this.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
And you're clever over there at Hyundai Motor Group.
Yeah, they are. This hybrid system in a lot of ways is more like the Hybrid Max system that Toyota has on the Crown and on the Grand Highlander. But it's not quite as powerful as that, but it is more efficient than that one. So it's kind of a nice blend because that one also uses a conventional transmission and a turbo 4-cylinder.
Yeah, I think a 6-speed, right? With the turbo 4. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the Telluride and the Palisade Hybrid. And then let's see. I don't think either of you went to the Dodge Charger drive program, did you?
I'm invisible to Dodge.
I did not. We had some other
folks. I got invited, but I didn't have time to go to that one, so I had to take a pass. But Nicole went to it. And so she got to drive the Dodge Charger 6-pack on the tail of the Dragon in North Carolina, which
very
is
nice.
A stretch of road with hundreds of curves. And
I think it's 318, if memory serves.
Yeah, that sounds
about
right.
11 miles or something. I've driven it a few times. Fantastic piece of highway. Don't go faster than 35 miles per hour because the Blount County sheriffs will find you. From what I've heard, I never had any trouble, but
yeah,
I've been told go slow.
Paul did get to drive it, and she's got her right up on top speed. And so, you know, this is the first internal combustion version of the new Charger. You know, the Charger Daytona launched, beginning of this year with EV only. It has not been a huge sales success. I think through the first 9 months of the year, they sold about 4,500 of them, which is, not great.
Oof. You mean the Angry Tim video didn't sell it?
No.
Is that so the one weird. Where he was with the Dodge brothers?
That is the one, yes.
No.
We're going to grab it. I'm like, oh, jeez. Like, I don't want to buy anything from this man.
That did not convince the muscle car fans to go buy one of these.
No.
It was very,
which is a shame.
Also, the price tag, too, is a big help.
Yeah.
A lot of working against that car.
Yeah. So, I mean, when they did the backgrounder, you know, and gave us all the details on the new Charger back in April or so of last year of 2024, March or April of last year, you know, they confirmed at the time, and it had been speculated for a while, that the Charger would also be available with an internal combustion engine. And mm-hmm. right now, you can get it with the 3-liter Hurricane 6-cylinder at 550 horsepower. And it's quick. It's not quite as quick as the EV, but it's still. I think it'll do 0-60 in about 3.6 seconds. It's still all-wheel drive only. So there's no rear drive version of this available.
That makes sense with all that power and torque.
Yeah, and you know this is a big car. I mean, it is a big car. It's like six or 8 inches longer than the old Charger. And 2 inches wider than the old Charger wide body. So, driving this thing on something like the tail of the Dragon would be interesting because mm-hmm. it tends to fill up the road. You know, we drove it on some mountain roads, drove the EV on some mountain roads in Arizona last December. And it was challenging to keep in the lane.
It's a lot. You mm-hmm. can land. You can land planes on the bonnet, like helicopters. Put a big H on it. You can have some executives.
No. One of your flying cars. You can land.
You can drive an eVTOL, fly an eVTOL, land it on top of the Daytona Charger. Yeah, no, it's ready for our Charger Daytona.
On the other hand, that size
an aircraft carrier.
The size does mean that the back seat is very usable. Yeah, it's adults can sit in the back seat comfortably, much more so than in the old Challenger. Mm-hmm. Right now, I think that you can only get the 6-pack in the 2-door, but it will be coming to the 4-door fairly soon as well. And it's also fairly certain that in the not too distant future that there will probably be a Hemi-powered Charger as well.
I mean,
that's the one everyone's going to buy. The least efficient, the worst power.
But the 6 but is so much Hemi. Better on paper. Yeah.
But it says Hemi. Yeah. Doesn't matter.
There's something about this car, too. It's very unattractive in photos. It just, pictures don't do it justice. You've got to see one in person. Yeah, every time I see a photo of one, I'm just like,
it's like, it's even though it's really big, like any 3/4 front shot makes it look smushed. It's I think it's that little bow on the hood. Like if you don't see it in profile, if you look at front on at 3/4, it just looks like that front end is just smushed and weird.
For me, the side view mirrors, the housings, just, they need to redesign those. They just don't, they just look blobby and melted.
They just found some off the mark. They're like looking at the rack. They're like, yeah, those would do. There you
go. Found them in an auto zone or something.
Exactly, right?
They stepped into the zone. Get some
fake portholes and put them on the fenders, you know, a little plastic. Buick style.
I mean, especially in person, I do like the design of this car. I think it's a good looking car overall, and yeah, it definitely looks better in person than it does in photos.
I agree.
The question, of course, will be, you know, will it actually work better? Because I don't know if you've talked to Nicole recently, Craig, but she bought a Wagoneer S, which is on the same Stella large platform. It has not been a great experience.
I saw her post on like Instagram. I think it breaks down every other week, apparently.
Pretty much, yeah. It has not been a great experience. So hopefully, the 6-cylinder version of the Charger will work better.
We'll see. See if it sells. Just keep putting motors in it until something happens.
Here, I was looking up the pricing. There's the 26 Charger Scat Pack Plus. With the Hurricane, maxed out, goes for $70,000.
No, dead on arrival at that price. Like, come on.
I still understand why they're like, hey, how about Scat Pack? You mean like a sack of poop? Like,
just... it's a heritage inspired name. Come on.
They do start at $55,000. Which is
that's a bit more palatable. But like, even the Mustang GT is absurdly expensive if you look at the base price. It's just like, who, why? Also, this Dodge, no manual transmission, right? It's auto only.
They didn't have a manual on the old Charger. They did. You could get it on the Challenger, I think, but only with the Pentastar.
I don't think the Dodge
people know how to drive a manual. I mean, they haven't had a manual for 100,000 years.
Yeah, you don't need a manual in a muscle car. I mean, you want to be able to brake torque it so you can spin it out. Yeah.
Me driving that 350 Mustang GT, it's got a manual.
It's
pretty magical.
The Shelby. It's, I dare say, even some voodoo.
That is my favorite Mustang of all time, the GT 350.
Yeah.
All right.
Just the thing revs to the moon. But so does a standard Coyote too. Like, those just rip.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Nissan Rogue plug-in hybrid.
Did you guys
take a look at these pictures yet?
I have not. So I've been in another country, but I've heard rumblings. Let's see. Hold on.
I looked at the specs for this, Sam. I have a question for you because you may have attended a background or something. Are they just taking the Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV drivetrain and copying and pasting that to the Rogue now?
It's more than that. They have literally just put a different grille on a Outlander plug-in hybrid. And different taillights. That is literally the only change.
I guess they did. Yes, there it is.
Yeah, this is an Outlander.
A Nissan badge. Because the Outlander PHEV is it's a nice vehicle, I would say. Nice SUV. It's just not very efficient as a hybrid. Like the Mitsubishi technology, they use their own drivetrain in there, right? It's like a 2.4 liter four cylinder, but not particularly efficient for what it is.
Yeah, it's rated at 38 miles of electric range,
which is good. But the fuel economy is
in hybrid mode. It's only like 26 miles per gallon, which is not great. When I got the link to the embargoed information a couple of days ago, I opened up the folder and I looked at this. Why? Because they've been talking about this one for a while. You know that they're going to do a plug-in hybrid version of the Rogue. And I looked, it's like, this is just an Outlander with a Nissan grill on it. And actually just the top portion of the grill, like between the topmost portion between the headlights. The rest of the front fascia is unchanged. And so I reached out to Nissan and asked some questions, and they reminded me that earlier this year, you know, Nissan announced some future plans. Among those plans are that the there's going to be a new Rogue, a redesigned Rogue, coming in 2026, and that is going to offer Nissan's next generation e-Power system. So that's their series hybrid system. Mm. That's coming to the Rogue next year, and the Rogue currently is built in Smyrna, Tennessee, and it's Nissan's best-selling vehicle in North America by a fairly wide margin. So there's going to be an all-new Rogue next year with e-Power. And the Outlander is actually built in Japan at a Mitsubishi plant. Even though the Outlander and the Rogue, the current generations, are on the exact same platform. They have the same dimensions, the same wheelbase, everything. Mm-hmm. They are, for all intents and purposes, the same vehicle. So Nissan could have taken the Mitsubishi plug-in system, put it into the Rogue that they're building here, except because they're already going to be retooling to build the new Rogue in Smyrna, it didn't make sense. So for 2026, there's actually two distinctly different looking Rogues. I mean, a lot of the underpinnings are the same, obviously, but they're very different looking versions of the Rogue. And so what we have is the Rogue plug-in hybrid is basically just a regrilled Outlander plug-in hybrid.
The Roguelander.
Yes, the Roguelander. One other thing that they did remove from the Rogue plug-in hybrid is it does not have the CHAdeMO DC fast charging that the Outlander offers.
Which sunset that port, finally. Yeah.
Well, you know, when I drove the Outlander plug-in a couple of years ago, you know, I opened the charge port door and saw, you know, the CHAdeMO port. Why bother with this? Because even with the CHAdeMO, it was still only 22 kilowatts, which means that it would take, you know, for just 20 kilowatt hour battery, it would take you an hour to charge it anyway at 22 kilowatts. Mm-hmm. So why even bother with that?
Correct.
Yeah, nobody's.
And aren't the CHAdeMO chargers in the U.S. capped at, like, I want to say 50 kilowatts? The
yes.
technology can yeah. handle more, but I think they're limited yeah. artificially
there's
here.
There's nothing that's more. It's like, yeah, well, there's no point.
I mean, the only other cars that have ever been sold with CHAdeMO in the U.S. are the Nissan Leaf and the Mitsubishi iMiEV. Yeah, and I can't remember what the max charging speed was on the iMiEV, but the Leaf, you know, it was 50 kilowatts. So nobody ever bothered to install CHAdeMO chargers with more. Well, they would charge. Actually, some of the Electrify America stations that have two cables, you know, where they've got a CCS and a CHAdeMO cable, they are 150 kilowatt chargers. But I think they will only put out 50 on the CHAdeMO cable.
Side.
But it doesn't matter because that's all the car can accept anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not.
It's the Chevy Bolt of Japan.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Rogue plug-in hybrid buyers, you're not losing anything by Nissan dropping that port. There was no real benefit to it. But other than that, yeah, it is literally an Outlander plug-in hybrid with a different grill.
For a year.
Well, no, I think they're going to continue to sell this at least for a couple of years.
So they just had a bunch of extra Mitsubishi motors around. They want to get a hybrid into the market as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Put it on there, and the next year we'll have our new system, which I drove in Japan.
The yeah, e-Power?
I think I can say that I did that.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Well, you just did, so.
Well, anyway, I drove in Japan. It was nice.
You just can't say what you thought of it.
Yeah, I think that's maybe what. Yeah.
The
embargoes on that trip were just all over the place. Every person you talked to gave you a different answer, and I was just like, "Oh my god,
that's helpful."
Yeah. Two years ago, Nissan did show us details of the system. It wasn't available to drive yet, but the next gen system is significantly lower in cost than the current gen, and should be more efficient. It'll be smaller package, so better packaging for it, and it'll, you know, it should be notably more efficient than the current generation, because I think part of the reason why they never bothered to launch the e-Power in the current generation Rogue, because they actually, they do sell it overseas with e-Power. Mm-hmm. In the rest of the world, what we know as the Rogue is sold as the X-Trail. And so in Japan and Europe, they do sell the X-Trail with e-Power. But if you look at the fuel economy numbers for it, it's only like about one, maybe 1.5 miles per gallon. By the time you convert from WLTP to EPA and everything, it's only about 1 to 1.5 miles per gallon better than the 1.5 liter three cylinder. So it wasn't really worth it, but the new system should be more efficient. So we'll see. And then, you know, we also don't know anything about pricing on the Rogue. They haven't announced that yet, but it'll probably be somewhere in the $45,000 to $50,000 price range, same as the Outlander.
Mm-hmm. So not cheap.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Toyota officially inaugurated their first North American battery plant this week. They announced this plant back in 2021. And at the time, they only said it was going to be a $1.3 billion investment. Since then, that has grown to almost $14 billion. And at the time that they announced it, they said that it was going to build, they were initially going to build batteries for hybrids. And given how many hybrid vehicles Toyota sells and builds in North America, makes sense. So this is a 30 gigawatt hour capacity lithium ion battery plant. But they're doing more, like most of the other plants of similar size of 30 gigawatt hours or so typically cost about $4 to $4.5 billion. And this one is $13.9 billion. And it turns out the reason why is because they're also doing all the cathode and anode material processing. They're just getting raw materials and doing that material processing in the plant.
So very vertically integrated then.
Yes. And they're building the modules and battery packs there as well.
Nice. So yeah. It's easy to call CATL and have them send you battery cells, right? It's quite another thing to build the cells yourself to install in the pack that goes in the car.
Yeah.
And so good for them.
And produce all the materials. So, it's definitely probably the most integrated, vertically integrated battery plant in North America. They actually started shipping battery modules to the Georgetown assembly plant back in June, and they've been putting them into Camrys, and I think they're also shipping them to Alabama, where they put them in the Corolla Cross Hybrid and in the Mazda CX-50 Hybrid. That's right now. They've got the plan is for 14 production lines. They've got 3 running now. They're installing the 4th right now, and then over the next couple of years, they're going to install the rest. And this plant is also going to supply batteries for Toyota's new 3-row electric SUV, which should be coming eventually, sometime.
Should be coming eventually.
Someday.
Very specific time.
The original plan is it was supposed to launch in 2026. They haven't said anything different yet, but my guess is that we probably won't see it till 27, because I think their original goal was also to unveil it like next week at the LA Auto Show, and they're not going to be doing that. So I think we'll probably see it sometime in 26 and launch in 27.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of us. Well, anyway, continuing on.
He nearly said too much, folks.
Yes.
About what I don't actually know, but.
Tesla is reportedly testing CarPlay. Tesla has been, along with Rivian and some other startups, has been avoiding incorporating CarPlay or Android Auto in their vehicles. But now they are apparently maybe finally going to give up and put CarPlay in there?
Maybe.
Let's hope so, because why wouldn't you just use CarPlay and Android Auto? It's give your customers the option of choosing. That's give my stance.
Give the people what they want to sell
your car. Yes, so GM's going to learn a hard lesson, I think, with their products not having CarPlay in it. That people are going to want that, and they're going to go elsewhere.
don't know. Have they actually learned a lesson from that?
Well, I'm assuming have they learned a lesson, period. But...
Well, that...
that's an evergreen question.
Yeah,
exactly. But I think they're, I wouldn't be surprised if in like 2 years, they're like, oh, new and improved CarPlay is back in your Silverado, in your GMC Savannah. We've got CarPlay.
For reals. You can't take something away if you haven't, and again, I've talked about this, you can't take it away until you've bested the thing you're taking away, and they have not.
I think there's one word I would change in that statement, is that you shouldn't take something away.
Oh, man.
You certainly can take it away.
You can do whatever you want. Yeah, you can do it. It's your car company. Do what you want. A lot of people are like, oh, it doesn't have CarPlay. Blah. I'm like, what? That is a decision that automatically turns off, you know, an audience of buying your car. Why would you do that? Especially now.
Exactly.
And I understand why. And then they got zapped for, you know, essentially selling data without telling people. So now they can't do that.
Only because they got caught, though.
Yeah, only because they got caught. So, yeah, I mean, the reason for not wanting CarPlay isn't because they're making something better. The reason is because they have more data on you that they can sell. They don't want that data. You know, they don't want Apple getting that data. They would rather have control of that data. And then they got in trouble for it anyway. So they can't do it for, I forget what the how many years they're not allowed to sell the customer data.
Good that they're trying it. I mean,
well,
I support that fully.
Do you think that if Tesla adds CarPlay to their vehicles, it will do anything to juice their sales?
No, I think the brand is too toxic at this point for a lot of drivers. Also, people are still... for better or worse, they're still lenient about EVs. I think that's partially why we're seeing this $10,000 discount we talked about earlier on some of the Hyundai products, right? Or the Kia models. Just because they're not selling as well as they should be. And I don't know that adding CarPlay is going to move the needle enough for people. We need
for Tesla? No.
Yeah, maybe especially
a
little for bit. Tesla.
There might be a few people, but adding something is fine, but taking something away is a completely different beast. That's where it comes. Like Rivian, because people would argue with me. They're like, well, Rivian, Tesla. I'm like, yeah, but they never offered it. And so you already went into their sort of social agreement was, we're going to do this because we're going to do it better, whether or not that's true or, you know, whatever. But that was the social, you know, that was the agreement they made with their customers. Is, you know, GM was like, yeah, we're going to have now we're taking it away. And they're a legacy automaker. And you're like, well, why? And you're not offering something better.
Because shareholder value.
Shareholder value.
They can scoop up all of that delicious, succulent data and then sell it off to other people.
Delicious data.
Mm. I'll take a glass, please.
Give me all that
nice, steamy glass of data. I guess it's data. In a glass. I don't know. However you want your data, you can have it.
Yep. As a gravy, because, you know, Thanksgiving's coming up. Or
a data a sandwich, perhaps?
A pie, a data pie.
Data pie? A pumpkin savory spiced, or sweet, though?
Pumpkin spice data pie. That's what it is.
Sounds right. Like I'm done.
So Jeep started making some announcements this week. And they've got more coming next week that we'll talk about on the next show. But the... The big thing that they announced this week was Jeep brand airdrops. They're going to do monthly special editions. I mean, they've long done special editions of various Jeep models, especially the Wrangler. And now to celebrate 85 years of quote unquote off-road domination, they're going to be doing a special edition Wrangler every month for the next 12 months. Starting with this first one, which is the Jeep Wrangler Moab 392, a very purple four-door Wrangler with this new Moab trim level that they're launching this year.
I thought you were going to say new 6.4 liter Hemi, but.
The 6.4 liter is old.
New.
The 6.4 is old, and it's been in the Wrangler for a while. The Moab trim is new, and it's going to be coming to other Jeep models. But, what do you think of this idea? I mean, is this going to help Jeep to sell more vehicles?
I mean, It's a huge. I mean, I think at the end of the day, these are all just going to be different paint jobs after a while.
Yeah.
You're going to get two that have maybe some mechanical differences, and then 10 that are just different paint jobs. Which, if you can support that in your paint shop, cool. If it's stickers, whatever. It's, yeah, I mean, we'll probably get an 80s version. I think a lot of people love that 80s version they showed off at, I think, SEMA. So, yeah.
It was at the Easter Jeep Safari.
Easter Jeep Safari, yeah. So, yeah, I think you're just going to see a lot of paint, which is fine. I mean, more graphics.
If you want it, get it, right?
Yeah. If you want it, get it. I don't, you know, Stellantis isn't doing great financially, so they really can't afford to like go, you know, crazy mechanical wise with these vehicles. But it'll be interesting to see how many they sell. And if, you know, it generates, you know, if they have a Supreme one, that's the one they should be building. For old people who are really into this. 392 Supreme, you know, something from 10 years ago. That's what it's always fun is when we were looking at the Dodge Charger or the Daytona Charger, it was like AC/DC when you're driving. I'm like, I guess you know your customers.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. Just listen to some new music. You got to get people younger than 40 into your vehicles.
Yeah, people younger than 40 can't afford groceries.
That's true.
So a $80,000 Moab Jeep Wrangler.
I guess. All right. Let's go back. I guess AC/DC works. It should have been Metallica. Come on. Even though
this is very classic Stellantis, and especially Jeep. Like whenever they run out of other ideas or something, they kind of come out with a special edition model of something with unique trim or different wheels. Or it's the
last year. This is the last year we're going to make this, and then the next year is the last year. It's like the Who. Exactly. It's always on. Well, speaking of old bands.
Well, I mean, you know, the. You know, the final editions of the Durango Hellcat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that one, when they first announced it in 2020 for 2021, it was supposed to only be for 1 year. And now 5 years later, they're still making them.
I remember I reviewed that vehicle locally. I had one on loan, and it was the last edition model. And I put in my review, it's the last edition until it isn't. And my editor's like, no, you have to, what do you know? Did you hear something? I'm like, no, they're going to make more. Well, we better take this speculation out.
This is what they do.
Okay. It's Stellantis. Exactly. If they're making enough money, they're like, oh,
I don't care.
Just keep making it. And you're going to anger.
And then they kept building them. So
yeah, you're going to make people angry. But,
well, yeah. Speaking of making enough money, one of the things that popped up in my inbox this week, you know, was an email from Jeep PR. About the Compass, you know, for 2026. And for 2026, you know, the Compass was supposed to be all new, but then, you know, tariffs happened and they canceled their plans to retool their Brampton, Ontario assembly plant to build the new Compass there. And then they spent several months trying to decide what to do, and they finally decided to build it in Belvidere, Illinois instead, but not until 2027, which means until for the next 2 years, we still have the old Compass that we've had for nearly a decade now. Last year, like in 2024, 23, early 24, when Antonio Filosa, who's now CEO of Stellantis, the whole company, was brought in to run Jeep after Christian Meunier was departed. And one of the first things he did was he started cutting prices on Jeep models because he said they're too expensive. This is part of why the sales were down. So they're too expensive. One of the big things he talked about was, you know, we've slashed the price on the Compass down to only, you know, it's under $27,000 now. And if you look at Jeep.com, go to the build and price, it still shows the price is $26,990 for the 2025 Jeep Compass. Well, looking at the What's New release for 2026 for the Compass, it now starts at $30,990. So it went up by $4,000 for the
mere $4,000. Okay. Yeah,
that's nothing.
For the most affordable model.
With don't forget the delivery charge, which is
that's for the same model. Let me see here. Yeah, $26,900 to $30,990. No thank you.
Well, actually previously they had the sport model, which was the one that started at $26,990. So the Latitude was $28,765, and now it's $30,990. So it went up by $2,200 for the Latitude.
And what's the delivery charge now? $4,500?
Let's see. It's probably
have we hit five figures yet? No.
$78,000.
See, where does it say?
Probably 1995.
This is the other thing that annoys me about Stellantis now. They've changed around the build and price sites. Now you don't just get a summary at the end that has everything. There's somewhere you got to click to find it.
That's a trick.
Yeah. Ford build and price tool, you've got to go into like the payment options and then switch over to cash.
From lease to finance, yeah. So 1995 is the destination charge for the Compass.
Same for the Wrangler, $2,000. Woo-wee.
And that's where they get you, folks.
That's where they get you.
You could ship it FedEx for less.
Yeah. All right. One last item I want to talk about. We have talked at some length here about EVs potentially being too fast. Yeah. Too quick.
Too fast, too furious.
Do people really need cars that go 0 to 60 in 2 to 3 seconds?
Nope.
Not really.
No.
Apparently the Chinese government has plans to do something about that. Because, you know, a lot of the Chinese EV startups have been creating some of these insanely fast EVs, like the Xiaomi SU7 and various others, you know, that are, you know, 2.5 or so seconds, 0 to 60 times. And so the Ministry of Public Security has drafted new national safety standards that would require manufacturers to have the default setting in the car for 0 to 100 kilometers an hour, so 0 to 62 miles an hour, in no less than 5 seconds. So they can still have a mode where you can go faster, but that needs to be something that is specifically selected by the driver.
Kind of like a launch control almost.
Yeah.
So just regular old driving. That's
a good idea. I mean, you accelerate 0 to 60 in 5 seconds and you hit somebody, they're still going to perish. If you hit them in 2.7 seconds, they're still going to not be with
us
anymore.
They have 2.5 seconds to get out of the way. And that amount of speed, I mean, most people, they don't understand how quick those vehicles are until they do it, and then they, you know, the driver gets. I was in a car with somebody who we were doing. It was the Gigafactory launch or opening or whatever, and they were letting us use launch control on the Model S. Did it down, stopped. You know, at the end of the road, there was just a road on the factory land. You had to take a because it just ended, and you take a right. Well, the camera person I had taken with me, they had never experienced this, and when they did it, they were so like mesmerized or taken aback or surprised or whatever, they didn't realize, they didn't think about braking. So I'm like, brake. I think we had to like snap them out of it to brake so we didn't go launching into the desert. That's how fast Yikes. These systems are, because they sort of break your brain if you're not used to it. You're like, wah. And so the idea that just your average person is launching, you know, an SUV or, you know, because they're all SUVs now, down the road in their neighborhood in, you know, less than 5 seconds is terrifying.
So this makes a lot of sense, though. I mean,
yeah,
5 seconds is still plenty quick.
Yeah,
it's like very quick. You're not going to have any trouble merging on the highway.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
Yeah. But it's also kind of nice. I expected it to be much more draconian than that. That, like, no, you will not accelerate to 100 km/h faster than 5 seconds. But they're still offering that. You just have to enable it.
You have to turn it on.
Yeah.
Maybe you have to do a little like contra code, like A, B, A, A, B.
And of course, every time you get in and start the car, you know, it's going to go back to the default mode.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't.
Just like regen in a Hyundai product.
Yep. Yeah.
Level 3.
Well, that one doesn't.
I want iPedal, but it keeps turning off.
Yeah, it always goes to level 3, I think.
Yeah.
And you it goes to
whatever you left it at up to level 3. So it won't go to iPedal by default when you start it. But and then there's also a couple other things in here. For example, the new rules state that the manufacturers of both battery electric and plug-in hybrids have to be able to automatically cut off power circuits in situations such as when the speed changes by 25 kilometers per hour, that's about 15 miles an hour or more, within 150 milliseconds in either longitudinal or lateral direction. So basically, if you have had some sudden deceleration due to impacting something.
If you've hit or been hit by something, it's going to disconnect.
Yeah, I don't know how else you would drop 25 kilometers per hour in 150 milliseconds unless there's an impact involved.
You've got some really big honking brakes.
Brembo.
You got some Formula One brakes on your EV.
I got those Brembo, like, you know, 26-inch brake calipers.
They're larger than the wheels themselves.
They're larger
the
than
new
the wheels.
Brembo Mega Brakes.
Well, yeah, they sit on the outside of the car. They're just...
F1 cars will pull about 5 Gs of decel. So that's, yeah, that's some pretty serious braking performance. Let's see, what else?
It's kind of like the Fords used to have, they might still have them, the fuel pump cutoff switch, which a lot of other vehicles did not have historically. So if there were, ever was an impact, there was sort of a kill switch that would shut off the electric fuel pump. And sometimes those would get jostled or something and the car wouldn't start and you just have to reset it. So, yeah, kind of the electric version of that, I guess.
And then the other thing was with batteries. It must be equipped with a directional pressure relief and pressure balancing devices with designed pressure relief channels. So basically, they've got to have a system to be able to vent excess pressure out of the battery. So if there's gas is building up, but outside of the away from the passenger compartment, and then the battery compartment must not catch fire or explode for at least 5 minutes after a battery alarm, providing passengers adequate time to evacuate.
I mean,
so some pretty, I think some pretty reasonable rules.
Absolutely. It's smart they're not venting the battery gases into the HVAC system, so that's good.
Yeah.
And 5 minutes gives you
plenty of
enough
time to
hopefully
walk away, you know, make a call.
Yeah.
Get an Uber or whatever.
Whatever the 911 equivalent in China is, I don't know, but call 911.
Yeah. The emergency services. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, where there is a stretch of road near my house where there are always car fires. It's all gas cars that I haven't seen. And there was another one like a week ago, the same stretch within the same like mile. Like the
kid. Is it called like Insurance Fraud Boulevard or what?
I don't know. I was driving home like a week ago and there was a car that had been on fire. They were putting it out. I'm like, what is going on at this point? What is happening? Is there
a
mad
spike
scientist
that comes up when you drive over it that punches through your fuel tank?
I don't know. Is there a mad scientist with the lasers? Like, they're like.
It's the lightning strike capital of America, maybe.
Yeah,
every,
I don't. Just... It's such a weird phenomena, and it's all. It was a Camry. That's what it was on fire last time.
Hmm. So, that's not a car known for just spontaneously combusting. So
what is happening at this site?
Yeah,
going on?
Would be Ferraris and Lamborghinis.
They're like, what is going on at this site? I'm going to investigate more. I'm going to investigate more, which means in 10 minutes after this podcast, I'm going to forget I even mentioned it. And then in like 3 to 6 months, there'll be another fire in the exact same spot.
This is some good investigative local reporting you could be doing. Yeah.
It's like the area near the Bay Bridge where if you have wireless CarPlay, it just turns it off. Every car, it doesn't matter what manufacturer, like wireless CarPlay, it's turned off. Something's going on. Ghosts. I think it's ghosts or wizards. Are the ghosts of wizards.
That's
one of those.
Sure.
Poltergeist.
All right. On that note.
Like, why do we have Robbie on the podcast, Bill?
Thank you for joining us today, Craig.
It has been a pleasure, sir. I appreciate the invite. A lot of fun.
And we'll definitely have to have you back again soon. All right. Take care, everybody. Talk to you next time.
Thanks.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.